Fanning on 2FM.
Now, by now, most of us have seen Making a Murderer, and most of us have talked about nothing else over the last month. Anyone who has their own opinion on Stephen Avery and whether or not he killed Teresa Halbach, it's been all over news and television and newspapers, etc. One thing we probably all can agree on is that the investigation wasn't carried out correctly, to put it bluntly. And we can probably all agree also that one person was left out to dry throughout this whole thing, and that's Stephen's nephew, Brendan Dassey. He confessed, but later took back his statement and maintains to this day that he is innocent, forced into confessing by police who used his low IQ against him, amongst other things. Well, here to talk to us now about Brendan and what's happening for him now at this stage, so many years later, is his lawyer from the Centre for Wrongful Convictions of Youth, and that's Laura Nerider. Laura, you're very welcome to the programme and thanks a million for talking to us. We did see you in the Netflix documentary, but when did you actually get involved in Brendan's case?
Well, thanks, Dave. It's so great to be here. My centre has been involved in Brendan's case since shortly after his trial, so that would be since 2007. So we've been fighting for him for about 8 years now, and you know, it's a fight we're honored to take up.
Okay, just from your point of view, how did it all go so wrong for Brendan?
Well, you know, it went wrong for Brendan the same way it goes wrong for a lot of other people around the country, a lot of other juveniles in particular, who are questioned by police alone, without parents, without attorneys present, using the kinds of interrogation tactics that we saw in Making a Murderer. Brendan was brought into the police station on March 1st, that interrogation video that we saw in Making a Murderer. He was picked up at school. He was there in the interrogation room, like I said, without a parent, without an attorney present. And the officers used interrogation tactics against him that are widely, widely used in America, that, you know, involve confronting him with their unshakable belief in his guilt, shutting down his attempts to deny, his attempts to assert his innocence, and telling him that everything's going to be okay as long as he confessed, but that if he didn't confess, there would be trouble, and eventually feeding him the information that he then used to construct his confession. We saw that in Making a Murderer when they're feeding him the information about how Ms. Halbach got shot in the head. So what you see over the course of this you know, interrogation on March 1st, that's where you see it going wrong for Brendan. He's up against these psychological interrogation tactics, and you can see the result, a confession that's, I think, very, very clearly false.
Well, like the police themselves are trained to interrogate people, if you like. Now, by people, I mean adults and possibly adult criminals, not 16-year-olds, and certainly not 16-year-olds who have mental limitations, to put it bluntly. Like, were you shocked when you saw this, or is this what you come across every second day of the week?
Well, you know, police do interrogate juveniles, and they interrogate juveniles with mental limitations. Whether or not they should be doing that is it's a whole other question, and I think you're exactly right to bring that up. You know, Brendan's interrogation in some ways is shocking because of the amount of fact-feeding that we see happening during the interrogation, the way the interrogators are just giving him every detail about this crime, and he's just parroting it back. But in another sense, you know, what we see with Brendan's interrogation is representative of a lot of the false confession cases we see at our center. That's something we specialize in, our false confession cases, and particularly false confession cases involving kids, involving teenagers. And, you know, they all follow this pattern that I describe: confrontation, shutting down the attempts to express innocence, saying something like, it'll all be okay, everything's going to be just fine, you just need to say these things. And these kids, one after another, believe the officers, think everything's going to be okay, and end up giving a false confession.
But also, isn't it a case of feeding information that they should never be told in terms of an interrogation, that, you know, that the interrogator should be trying to get that kind of information out of the person they're talking to, rather than telling them these facts and trying to make them then weave these facts into some kind of story that supposedly will get them out and get them home, in this case home to watch wrestling on television or something. But once he admits to this kind of thing, he's never going to get out of anywhere ever again.
That's exactly right, and you're exactly right that feeding information is, you know, taboo during these interrogations, as it should be. Even the leading interrogation trainer here in the United States, the company that trains the majority of police officers here in the United States, everybody agrees. That company agrees that information should never be disclosed during an interrogation. So you're exactly right. It's a huge problem. But it is something we see with sort of too much frequency during these interrogations.
Okay, well then, like what we're talking about here is steamrolling kids to say whatever it is that they want to say then, and then like they think they're going to get home with that, and then the people who are making the questions or who are asking the questions get the kind of information they want. What is it that they want a lot of the time? I mean, is it like, for instance, even with the appeal system, like, can I assume that some things don't really get fixed at all on appeal? You know, is the appeal system, the criminal justice system, really designed not necessarily to get at the truth and justice, but to actually perpetuate a kind of a conviction, if you like? Very few cases ever get reversed on appeal, is what I'm saying.
Well, you're exactly right that it is difficult to get a case reversed on appeal because the appeals system is weighted in favor of what they call finality, right? Once a conviction has been obtained, let's keep it final. Let's keep closure for the victim's family. Let's all move on because there's the presumption that it's been done right the first time. So you're exactly right. Relief through the appeals process is hard to get. It's not impossible, but it's hard.
Well, then you're attempting the impossible then at the moment then. This is part of your job. So is Brendan Dassey's appeal still active? I mean, is he awaiting a ruling by a Wisconsin-based federal magistrate's court or whatever, or is he not?
It is active. So we have filed what's called a petition for a writ of habeas corpus, which is basically legal papers asking the federal courts, the United States courts in Wisconsin, to review the way the Wisconsin state courts handled Brendan's case. So those are papers that have been filed now for about 6 months, and we've been waiting for a ruling, and we're continuing to wait and hope for the best.
You, I presume, hadn't necessarily been following day-to-day the trial as it happened. Are you coming to it after or since or around the time, say, of the documentary being made, in terms of you saw that he was just another case that you have, if you like, and this was now made into a television program?
Well, we came to the case right after Brendan's trial happened. And
right.
It actually came to us because the founder of our center, Steve Drizin, was involved in creating the law in Wisconsin that required interrogations to be videotaped. And Brendan's was actually one of the very first interrogations in Wisconsin to be videotaped under that new law. And so it was sort of a natural fit. Okay, this kid needs help with his appeal. Let's pass it off to our organization. And when we got involved in the case, of course, we had no idea that a documentary was being made.
Yeah.
It's obviously not one of the criteria that we use to take up cases. But we became aware of that, of course, and got to know Laura and Moira a little bit as they were making the documentary. And, you know, we were so impressed with their thoroughness and their just painstaking attention to detail and their ethics. So, you know, it was sort of a unexpected but really beautiful surprise that they were making this series about this case.
And when you saw people like Len Kaczynski, who was there, or Michael O'Kelly in particular, and the way that those two worked together for supposedly Brendan's defence, which certainly wasn't that. In fact, even in court, Michael O'Kelly admitted that it actually wasn't. He wasn't there for that at all. Were you astonished, or were you in some ways like, are you delighted to see that, like, this is what you have to deal with every second day of the week, as I say?
No, our jaws hit the floor when we saw what Attorney Kaczynski and Michael O'Kelly did, in particular when we saw that videotape that was included in Making a Murderer of O'Kelly meeting with Brendan at the jail, and he's got the table with all the pictures and the blue ribbon and everything on that all spread out for Brendan, and then he's making him fill out that form. You know, we have never seen anything like that, not in my 8 years of practice, not in my co-counsel's 30 years of practice. That's not how defense attorneys work. That's not how defense attorneys should work. And we're shocked.
But, like, you know, when you talk about that, like, you know, Michael O'Kelly, he kind of coerces Dassey into massaging his statement so that it aligns perfectly with what the prosecution needs. And even though they're both working for Dassey, and there's an email from O'Kelly to Kaczynski then where he's not, it sounds like he's working for the prosecution. But, like, later on, you know, I think it's Robert Dvorak, Dassey's post-conviction lawyer, he presses O'Kelly in the stand on his unbelievable admission. He says, you know, so your goal is not only to get Brendan to confess, but also to help the state and its prosecution, correct? And he says, that's correct. Now, at that stage, do you not say, wait a minute, does the judge not step in and say, hold on a second, you know, what do you mean that's correct? You're supposed to be for the defense. You're for the prosecution.
Well, that's exactly right. It was one of the most shocking moments of the post-conviction hearing when O'Kelly said that. And, you know, 1,000 times when he was on that stand, it was abundantly clear that he was in this fight, not for Brendan, but for the prosecution, I think. And that is absolutely one of the things that we have raised in our papers before the federal court, pointing out, look, this kid, this poor 16-year-old child, you know, picture being him, right? Picture being him alone in a jail cell, age 16. You're intellectually limited. You probably have very little idea what just happened to you. And, you know, here comes your court-appointed attorney and his private investigator, and what do? They're just trying to make it worse for you. I mean, this is a horrible thing.
Is one of the things that they're trying to make it worse for Brendan Dassey is just to make the case worse for Stephen Avery. I mean, like, is it possible that that's really what it's all about? Like, let's get Avery, and everybody was trying to get Avery, and they were part of the get Avery conspiracy.
Well, you know, I can't speak for them as to what their motivations are. You know, I can just look at the evidence that we had, which, you know, whatever their motivations were, ended up being, the evidence shows that their actions were incredibly harmful to Brendan, Mm. You know, those first few months of representation are so critical, because that's when a loyal defense attorney and a loyal investigator should be out there talking to witnesses, you know, before people start forgetting things. They should be out there trying to drum up evidence on your behalf. And instead, these guys were doing exactly the opposite.
Well, what you're trying to do now for Brendan Dassey, if you had been there from the beginning, for instance, like, the team was never allowed to advance alternative theories as to who might have killed Hallback. Now, I know there's something in Wisconsin law about 30 days where you have to give a name, or whatever, but, like, surely that can be talked about. And, like, Stephen Avery himself, then, he doesn't go up on the stand. Is that a good thing or a bad thing, usually, if you're not a particularly great witness, even for yourself?
Just speaking generally, it's always, you know, it's a difficult decision for any person who is on trial to decide whether or not to take the stand.
But I mean, like, for instance, like, okay, then, just with Stephen Avery there, and I know it's Brendan Dassey we're talking about here in terms of your involvement, but if Avery did it, it couldn't have gone down the way Brendan Dassey described it. I mean, like, completely cleaning a couple of crime scenes, etc. So even on that level, Brendan's sort of confession, it just never holds water, does it?
It never holds water. You're exactly right. I mean, here's Brendan telling the police officers, after they're feeding him this information, you know, he's telling police officers about what seems to be a horribly bloody, really awful scene, right? And it's so clear that it is just fictional. I mean, those police officers, after Brendan made that statement, they went into Stephen Avery's trailer. They went into the bedroom where supposedly all this happened. And they looked at the bed. They looked at the headboard. They looked at the bed frame, the mattress, the bedding. They looked at the carpet on the floor. They even took the carpet off the floor, looked underneath. They took the paneling off the walls and looked behind it, searching for any drop of blood from Teresa Hallback or any hair from her head. Think about when you cut hair. Hair flies everywhere, right? It would be impossible to clean up every tiny trace of DNA from Teresa Hallback. And what did they find after that incredibly exhaustive search? Not a single trace of Teresa Hallback in that bedroom, and not a single trace of Brendan Dassey in that bedroom.
But also, it should be noted that during this frenzied attack, Stephen Avery was supposed to have made two very calm phone calls to his then girlfriend at the time, and, like, which is completely psychologically, I'm sure you could get somebody up on the stand and say, that's not going to happen.
Well, you know, again, I can't comment on Stephen's case because those, you know, phone calls relate just to him. But I will note, you know, those phone calls are nowhere in Brendan's confession, right? You know, and those are things we know
sure.
What happened.
In terms of Brendan's confession, would it be fair to say that the tactics that were used are simply a recipe from your experience in the past for a false confession?
That's exactly right. And that's what a lot of commentators who study police interrogations have said after watching Brendan's video. I mean, what you have is, you know, a teenager like Brendan, somebody who's 16. You don't even have to have the intellectual limitations to be vulnerable when you're a teenager. And when the tactics that were used, you know, sort of combine with the way teenage minds work, you do have a recipe for false confessions. You know, teenagers, everybody, right? Every parent out there, everybody remembers being a teenager. Every parent knows how teenage minds think. You know, teenagers, because of the way that their brains are sort of caught in mid-maturity, are not good at assessing risks. They're not good at assessing consequences. They are very vulnerable to pressure. They're impulsive. I mean, this is a sort of a toxic brew of traits when you get into the interrogation room and you're confronted with interrogation tactics that are intentionally designed to obfuscate and minimize the risks involved of confessing. You know, things like, it'll be okay, Brendan, don't worry, everything's going to be okay, just confess, right? So when you combine all this together, it absolutely is a recipe for a false confession.
Well, then, where are we now with this? For instance, like, if you see Brendan and if you see Stephen as probably 10 years ago, two of the most hated people in the state of Wisconsin, this television program has shown that they certainly should not be and are not, and there's enough people writing petitions to try to get them a second trial or get them off or whatever it happens to be. Do you think that television programs like this or the Dateline stuff in America and those kind of things, that they help hinder or might even sway a judge in the future, or should not have a, you know, I mean, do you think it could any, like, is it a good thing?
Well, you know, look, in the world of wrongful convictions, context is everything, right? And you're exactly right. In the past, for the past 10 years, you know, Brendan has been basically forgotten, and when he's been remembered, it's been as a murderer. And think how devastating that is for him to wake up behind bars in a cage, literally every day for the last 10 years with that, knowing that's how people think of him. And finally, finally, he's getting his story out there. Finally, people are seeing what happened to him. And, you know, that means the world to him, certainly. I mean, it can't be understated, the impact that this has in terms of giving him hope. And whether it's going to directly impact the ruling or not, I can't say, but I do think just changing the conversation and changing this people's awareness of what happened to Brendan, you know, the value of that cannot be understated.
What could he have done, by the way, or could he, like, this business about, like could he be out sooner if he took a plea bargain? What exactly is a plea bargain?
Well, a plea bargain would have involved the state making Brendan some sort of offer. Saying, you know, we'll give you some sort of reduced sentence in exchange for something, and presumably what you know is often asked for in plea bargains is the defense, is the person's testimony.
Well, that which got Stephen Avery out first time round was advancements in forensics, etc., and they realised that he was not guilty of the crime that he had been accused of and put into jail for 18 years before all of that. But what might now help Brendan or even Stephen? Is it, again, advancements in forensics or somebody coming forward with new evidence?
That's one thing we hope will flow out of making a murderer. You know, there are people out there. There's no question there are people out there in Wisconsin who know something about what happened and who know things that could help Brendan. And we're so hopeful that with all this buzz and all this incredible attention on his case, that these people will see that it's the right thing to do to come forward. You know, Brendan was 16, as we saw, when this happened to him. He's 26 years old now. He's, you know, living a life sentence behind bars. And we're just hoping that the truth comes out and the people who know the truth will step up.
And you, Laura, are the co-director of the Centre for Wrongful Convictions of Youth, and you've written many papers on this kind of thing. Do you get involved in cases only after somebody is convicted?
Usually. We occasionally consult before somebody's been, you know, before a trial, in trying to help defense attorneys plan a strategy in cases where it seems clear that the confession has been false. So we do get involved ahead of time when we can, but usually our mission is to work with people like Brendan who have been convicted already to try to undo those convictions.
There was a thing, by the way, just as a matter of interest, in terms of what Brendan said, that he came up with what he said, it happened from this book or the movie that I've seen, Kiss the Girls. His defence team never even read out a passage from that book to explain. Is that stuff not read? I mean, would there not have been a psychologist or somebody who could evaluate his IQ to be put up on the stand saying, I have seen the film of this confession, and believe me, in my experience, blah, 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 there is no way we could take this at face value.
Yeah, I think that would have been really, really useful, and that's something that we did actually at the post-conviction hearing. We called certainly one of the United States and probably one of the world's leading researchers on false confessions, Dr. Richard Leo, and he had studied Brendan's vulnerabilities and he had studied the interrogation videos, and he stood up and he said exactly those things. You know, this is why this confession can't be believed. This is why these interrogation tactics are a recipe for a false confession, so on and so on. And you're exactly right.
And Laura, has your job got easier or even more interesting because you now can point to this programme and a million billion people around the place can finally realise, right, now I see it can happen. Now I see what Laura's been doing all these years, and the people do genuinely, an awful lot of people of a certain young age give any kind of a bloody thing just to get out of the thing in terms of being interviewed by police. Like, do you see, like, see, that's why it can happen. Does it make it easier for you?
Well, I think it does. You know, people struggle. People struggle to understand why someone would confess to a crime they didn't commit, right? It's a very counterintuitive idea. And I understand that struggle, because when I first started learning about this stuff too, I thought, well, this sounds crazy. But the beautiful thing that making a murderer does is it makes that counterintuitive idea so easy to understand. I mean, that video, I think you're right, that, you know, millions of people who are watching this series totally get why Brendan said the things he said, and also totally understand that they are false. And that's huge for those of us who work in this field. It's huge for anybody really who cares about the integrity of the justice system, that this awareness is spreading.
And by the way, not so much the case that you're involved in terms of Brendan Dassey, but just the last 2 months, the last, say, 8 to 10 weeks, how has your life personally changed? I'm sure it's changed quite a lot.
Well, you know, I think all of the attorneys involved in the cases have been getting a lot of inquiries and phone calls. And the most important thing that we've been getting is letters of support for Brendan, emails, phone calls, those sorts of things, that's what's sustaining him right now. I mean, it means so much to him and to his family.
Okay, well, you've used the phrase right now. So finally, Laura, what is happening right now with Brendan? And, like, you know, are you the one doing everything to try to secure his release?
Well, you know, Brendan is, he's still in prison. He's working with myself and my colleagues and awaiting this decision on the federal writ of habeas corpus that we already mentioned.
Yeah.
And you know, we're continuing to follow up any and all leads that are coming forward on his case. And, you know, we're in this for the long haul, so we're going to be doing this until we see Brendan Dassey walk out of those prison doors.
And Brendan Dassey's case is only one of probably many that you're working on.
That's right.
Right, yeah. So the co-director of the Centre for Wrongful Convictions of Youth, and there's a lot out there by the sound of it, is Laura Nerider. Laura, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us on the programme today.
Thanks so much. It was a pleasure to be here. Dave Fanning on 2FM.